This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SeavillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SeavillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up in our right-hand margin. I'm Dan Daniels. Al Weed owns and operates Mountain Cove Vineyards in Nelson County. He has a BA from Yale in Latin American Studies and a master's degree in economic development and political modernization from Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Including active duty in Vietnam and Bosnia, he served a total of almost 43 years, mostly in the reserve components, retiring from Army Special Operations as a command sergeant major. Al worked for the World Bank and the Arthur Lipper Corporation before settling in Central Virginia and was a founder of the Virginia wine industry. He was involved in every significant legislative, regulatory, and organizational development of this now vibrant industry's first quarter century. Al is the founder of Rural Nelson, a land preservation group in his home county, and he has served as a board member, director, and trustee for numerous nonprofit concerns. At the request of the Governor of Virginia, he serves on the Virginia Land Conservation Foundation's Board of Trustees. Twice the Democratic candidate for the 5th District, he currently spends half of his time in the daily operations of Public Policy Virginia, acting as its executive director. Al's op-eds have been published in major publications, and he speaks frequently in all areas of the state about climate change and a broad range of other public policy issues. Al spoke at Northside Library at a meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia on November 12, 2008. The program was moderated by SSV board member and past president, Don Wells.
I first met Al Weed almost 5 years ago now. I was not politically active until that time, and so I had never encountered him. I would have if I had been active in local politics, but I was busy being a scientist, and I was in close to retirement. I started becoming more politically active, and I attended a meeting, and he gave a brief talk, and I was so impressed that I immediately wrote him a check. Shows just how persuasive he could be and the vision that he presented. His subject today is climate change. I'm a physical scientist. I can tell you there hasn't been a serious debate on this subject in 20 years. The physical science community reached consensus long ago. If you read the newspapers in recent years, journalists present it as though there's a 50-50 balance in argument. That's journalistic malpractice. Journalists don't tell the truth in this respect. They think everything has to be presented as a half and half balance of points of view. It's wrong. In fact, the balance is more like 95-5 among physical scientists and has been for a long time. That's a subject you should know about, a fact you should know. Now, with regard to Al Weed, there are three words in my mind that are associated with him, and they are courage, vision, and leadership. And the courage word is the one that I particularly noticed in him. And this is an example here, because climate change is a subject that's been controversial, and at the state level, there's been a tendency to not talk about it. Most people don't bring it up. Most politicians are unwilling to commit or to recognize scientific consensus and act on it. Al Weed has the courage to do it. Not just to talk, but to act. And so he has been instrumental in forming a public policy group to develop and promote public policies for our state. And that's Public Policy Virginia organization, which is a 501c3 organization, and you'll find the literature back here on the table. Al will tell you more about that, I expect. To do that kind of action in the current political climate requires vision, and taking a leadership position requires courage. And I am greatly respectful of Al for these things, and I welcome him to tell us about the problem of climate change for Virginia.
That was unusually gracious. Usually we write up something little that says where I went to school and how many children and what size shoes I wear, and Don, you did a much better job. Thank you so much. Let me just change this PowerPoint so we have the right one on. I know how to do it. Honest, I do. And what I need. Oh, while I'm doing this, does everyone have a pink card? You should have all gotten one when you came in. And does everyone have something they can write with on that pink card? If that's the case, then Marvin, your organization's done a great job. All right, let's see if we can. All right. Can everyone hear me? Mm-hmm. Yes, good. That's the topic. Don introduced it just fine. But what I want to do is, we have been talking all around the state on this general topic. And every audience is different. Every audience brings to the presentation a certain level of understanding or not understanding, and that's just fine. That's what this is all about, is communicating. So what we do is we like to take a quick survey before we start and see what our audience knows. And the scary part is then we do a very even quicker survey at the end and see whether we've actually communicated anything with you. So help us out on this. So you've had the pink card, you've got something to write with, and here's the quick survey. And all you have to do is write the number and yes or no. Don't put your name on it. We're not interested in knowing individuals' opinions. I'll be glad to hear them, but that's not what the survey is about. So the first question is, and if you have a question, as I read these questions, we try to make them as clear as possible, but we are imperfect at best. Raise your hand and make sure I can clarify it. The first question just says, do you believe, do you accept that fossil fuels are contributing to global warming? Yes or no? That's all you need to say. And if you're not sure, just lean toward the whatever balance you feel is appropriate. Second question, do you believe that we should reduce our use of oil to enhance our national security? Yes or no? Third, do you think a national move to a non-fossil-based energy will create new jobs and revitalize our rural communities? Economy, I think, of what I have here. Yeah. Yes or no? And finally, number four, would you support carbon taxes to affect your desired outcome on any of the issues listed? Bottom line is, if you answered yes to any one of the three above, would you support carbon taxes to see that come about or see progress in that area come about? So you should have four numbers and four yeses or nos. And Mrs. Abbott back here will collect them and we'll get on with the action. We are a great nation. We've just come through a momentous presidential campaign and election. And for many, and I suspect for most of us, whether we won or lost this one, there's a great deal of pride in the fact that it went smoothly, that people's voices were heard, and we have made, it was a historic campaign as we know. But our greatness is often shown in the way we deal with challenges. Ever since the battle at Yorktown, America has overcome challenges that would have felled a less confident people. I'm sure each of us has our own list of these defining issues in our history. Mine would include the Civil War. It would include the Great Depression, World War II, and the Civil Rights Movement. In each of these, Americans had to know where they stood and had to take part in the process. No one was left out in these things. And in the end, while these may have been seen, while and they were, in fact, not, this is not perception, this was reality, these were crises that made our nation stronger. Now, in addition to existential crises such as the Civil War, we have faced economic and social challenges that have given us the opportunity to grow and prosper, even though at first the future looked pretty gloomy. The abolition of slavery was perceived as destroying the economy and the plantation system in the South. Yet today, the South is modern and prosperous. Our racial issues are being dealt with, and we have come well beyond that period of time. That's a picture of Atlanta, which is, by every measure, a large, prosperous, urban, sophisticated city, which many would have thought the South could never foster. The Dust Bowl in the 1930s, a major economic crisis that, of course, was overlaid with the Great Depression, but it caused mass migrations from farms that were too often stuck in old-fashioned land tenure patterns and were using obsolete farm techniques. Our response to this great environmental catastrophe actually led to new kinds of farming, led to new understanding about the connection between how we manage the land and how we produce from the land. And today, America is the world's breadbasket because we learned from that crisis. We built a new agricultural economy on it. In the early 50s, the perceived threat from the Soviet Union in the Cold War led Dwight D. Eisenhower, our president at the time, to call for an investment and lead an investment in the interstate system. And that interstate system was built in response to what we all thought of as a crisis. Many of you are old enough, some of you are just the right age to remember hiding under your desk in grade school when they would practice the air raid stuff because we were scared of atomic bombs. And I never did, even at that young age, think what good a desk would do if we got atomic bombed, but teachers didn't allow that kind of questioning. But there was a crisis, and there was a solution, and the interstate system, of course, has tied us together economically in ways that nothing else would have ever done on this great continental nation. We did some research on it. If we were to take the amount of money that was spent on the interstate system from 1956 through 1991, which is the sort of period they say it took to complete it, in today's dollars, that would be $452 billion. Now, I hope you all agree that's still a lot of money, even though we see these other things out there. But another way to look at it, looking at the value of the interstate system, is to say if we were to build that interstate system today in order to build that value or that that part of our economy, it would cost $7.232 trillion. So as a result of a crisis, we made investments as a nation, and today we benefit from those. Another challenge, after World War II, was a great challenge to reintegrate the returning GIs as they came home. How were we going to kickstart our economy, take it off the war footing that we had, turn it back to civilian production, and integrate millions of young men who had been fighting overseas for some as long as 5 years? Well, we came up with the GI Bill. We came up with veterans benefits. And we ended up with a period of prosperity, a period of dramatic growth, such that America was able to turn and rebuild our allies and even our enemies with the prosperity that we developed. So we know as a nation how to respond to crises and do something that will benefit us in the long run. Let me add one more, and one I think that is probably most relevant to the topic of my conversation this morning. Late 1950s, the Soviet Union put a satellite into space. We were embarrassed. We thought we had the best technical education in the world. We thought we were the smartest, most advanced nation in the world, and all of a sudden, the Soviets were orbiting the Earth, and we were looking up and wondering. Well, that led to a massive investment in technology, a massive investment in science in our schools. It was a complete mindset change, I think, in the late 50s and in the early 60s. And much of the technology that's associated with that response to the Soviet threat in the Cold War and the Soviet challenge in space underlies what today we take for granted as technological advances. The internet, a lot of the enhanced communications that we use, all of these have come from responding to a challenge, not the least of which was actually putting a man on the moon and doing it so far as the only nation ever to put men on the moon. But today we're facing a challenge, I believe, that's even more than any that I've mentioned. It is both an existential challenge and it is an economic challenge. Climate change and global warming are what we have to deal with. And the number that matters most is that number right up there, 350 parts per million. Scientists agree that above 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we are approaching a tipping point for where some of the changes that result from global warming and climate change will not be reversed. And as I talk later about positive feedback loops, you'll see some of these things feed on themselves to get worse. 350 is the number that many scientists have come to accept as the sort of barrier number. Unfortunately, we're at 385. And we haven't slowed. So where does that leave us? Obviously, that leaves us facing a massive challenge. And it won't be easy. Let me quote what President Kennedy said when he announced the plan to put a man on the moon by the end of the 60s. John Kennedy said, "We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not only because they are easy, but because they are hard, because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we are willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one which we intend to win." He reached out to America and said, "This is a challenge, we can meet it, and we can grow in doing it." We have that same opportunity today, at this crucial time, to take climate change and build a new economy, secure energy independence, and start to reverse the so far inexorable buildup of greenhouse gases. If we don't, life will change on this planet in ways that are very difficult for us to predict, but we know they will change. And the window is not large. We don't have much time to do the things we need to do to slow the carbon loading of the atmosphere. But the rewards will be great, just as they have been with these other challenges America's faced. The rewards will be great. So far, as we know, it has been easier. Don alluded to it. It's been easier for politicians to duck the hard questions. It's much easier to say, "Well, that's beyond my term, and that just happens to be Bush," but he stands for everybody in this case. No politicians are willing to say, "Yes, we've got to do the hard things." I remember when the Democrats won and took over the Senate in 2006, and the new chairman of the Senate Environmental Committee, Senator Boxer from California, was being interviewed before the Senate had come into session. So she was the chairman designee, if you will. And the interviewer kept saying, "Well, what are we going to ask people to do? What can we expect people to..." He actually used the word sacrifice. Senator Boxer would not respond. She would not say that any of us needed to do anything differently. So this is a bipartisan failure, I believe, to face the reality that is upon us. And we can't afford that anymore. Now, I'm here today, as Don said, as the chairman of Public Policy Virginia. There are a lot of things that we as individuals can do, and I'll briefly talk about those a little bit later. But in the end, the changes that are necessary to reduce global warming, to hopefully either slow the climate change or at least prepare ourselves to adapt to what is going to happen, and I'll give you some of those facts, is going to take changes in public policy. That's our focus, the public policy things. Now, I know that many of you are familiar with the science of global warming, but I will go over that just very quickly and briefly. And I suspect that some of it may be old hat to you, but if it's not, it will be sure at least that we all understand the same things. And I'm also going to make a case for renewable energy from what we call biomass resources, fuel crops, switchgrass, wood waste, anything that is organic that right now could be turned to energy. I will talk a little bit about how Virginia has some distinct advantages in that and how a strong biomass economy can make a strong economy in the Commonwealth. Well, global warming is happening. Don has said it's happening. Fact is, most of us, this is the slide I should have had up to say, it's about we influence public policy so that when you go to vote, you're able, or you are approached by a candidate, you're able to ask that person, "What do you think about X?" And you have some facts about X. something you believe about X. You want to know what he or she is going to do. And then when you go to the voting booth, you make your decisions, among other things, on where they are on these issues. Okay. The big bad news last year or earlier this year was that 2007 was indeed, in fact, as hot as we thought it was. This list is in order of the hottest of the top 10 years that we've been able to measure. And temperature measurements, at least in North America, go back 150 years. So if you take this top 10 list and you look at the ones in red, that's the ones that I highlighted, there are 6 out of the last 10 years, that's 1998 through 2007, 6 out of the last 10 years are in the top 10 hottest years we have ever known. This is clearly a trend toward warming. And there's no doubt about it, and it will have dramatic impacts. Now, why is this happening? Well, the science, as Don said, is pretty well accepted, and the physics is actually pretty, the physics is undeniable. Let's just follow the numbers. Solar radiation, the sun is what keeps us alive. Solar radiation comes down through this blanket of gases, passes through the gases, hits the Earth, is absorbed by the Earth, is reflected back or refracted back as infrared, and it will go back out, that heat. Some of it goes back out into the atmosphere, and some of it stays in. And it's this blanket of gases that, just like on a cold winter night, if you're caught outside, it's that blanket that has kept us alive. It's that blanket that allows us to thrive, that have life on Earth, because the other planets in our solar system do not have that blanket of gases. So while they may get a great deal of sunlight and sun's energy, they don't have anything to capture it. That's why it's called the greenhouse gases, because it's those gases that have allowed us to have life as we understand it on Earth. Now, what happens when that you put two blankets on? Well, it gets pretty hot under two blankets. And so what do you do? Well, if you've gotten two on and it's a dumb thing to do, you throw one off. It's not so easy when the blankets are in the atmosphere and they represent gas that we have or that has come off the Earth. The CO2 blanket is especially difficult because the CO2 blanket will last 100 years. CO2 that we put in the Earth in the air today will be there 100 years from now. So that's why it's important that we start now to reduce this, because we're on a downward slope, depending on how you look at it, and a very dangerous one. Okay, once the gases have come through, they're creating this blanket. Now, there's a whole range of gases. And so it's not just CO2. Methane from rotting organic matter, from cow flatulence. People always talk about, well, what about cows? And methane is a serious gas. Methane is 23 times more powerful in its blanking in effect than CO2 is. But on the other side, methane will only last 8 or 9 years in the atmosphere. So it's something we may be able to get control of. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. Water vapor gets up into that blanket and helps refract heat back down. So the more water vapor you have in that blanket, the thicker the blanket, the warmer we're going to get. So there's a whole range of nitrous oxide. There's a whole range of greenhouse gases. But the one that is the most, that is causing us the most problem, is CO2. And here's what's happened, of course. Since the beginning of the industrial age, we have burned fossil fuel to power our energy, to power our industry, and quite frankly, to power the prosperity that we enjoy as modern Americans, at least, and many in today's world. And what that means is the fossil fuel, the oil, the natural gas, the coal, is taking out of the Earth organic matter that was sequestered or stored in the Earth over millennia, millions of years ago. And when it is burned, the CO2 in that fossil material is released into the atmosphere. So this is new CO2 as far as our atmosphere is concerned today. Well, when we burn a lot of that, we keep putting it up there, and it is adding to it. So the use of fossil fuels is clearly associated with the increase in global temperatures. And they have cores that have gone into the Greenland ice, and they're able to measure this quite accurately. Now, human activity is responsible for a little over 3% of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That doesn't sound like a lot, but in fact, it is a significant amount when you're talking about disrupting the normal effect of that blanket that we're talking about. Now, what the difference is, if we use renewable energy, if we use biomass energy, if we use energy from trees, from grass, we have what's called a closed loop. Yes, when we burn ethanol made from corn, I don't advocate that, but that's the one we're most familiar with. When we burn ethanol made from corn, we release CO2 in the air. There's no doubt about it. But when that corn is grown, it pulls CO2 out of the air. So that's what's called a closed loop. So the real difference is, do we want an open loop or do we want a closed loop? And the answer has to be a closed loop. Now, okay, the Earth is getting warmer. What does that mean? Well, the physics of sea level rise is fairly understood. As the water increases in temperature, it expands. That's pure physics, and we know that. What we don't know is how fast it will be, and we don't know what the total impact will be of the water, of the sea levels rising. These are some pictures that talk about places that you may or may not be familiar with if the sea levels rise 1 meter. And most models, most scientists are predicting a meter. The Governor's Climate Change Commission actually is looking at, I don't know whether it will come out in their final report next month, but is actually looking at 2 meters by the end of this century. And so this is what happens to places like Dover Beach. All of the blue is flooding what is now homes and whatever they have there. Foster City, California, Point Pleasant, New Jersey, I'm not really familiar. Hollywood, Florida, I'm not really familiar with these places, although at one of these presentations, a man came up to me afterwards and said, he said, let me have your little pointer. I said, sure. He said, I used to live right there. So he knew that part of Foster City. He knew what was going to be flooded. And as I said, we don't know the totals. We do know that it's going to happen, and we don't know when. Now, the other thing that people have associated with global warming, and there seems to be a reasonably close association, is weather. And it's not whether it's going to rain today or tomorrow. It's the overall nature of weather. How many people have lived in Virginia most of their lives? How many of you remember the kind of tornadoes we had this spring? I've only lived in Virginia for, maybe all but 10 of my life, but I don't ever remember tornadoes like hit down in the eastern part of our state this spring. That's a Midwestern phenomenon. But that's coming because the Earth is warmer, these storms gather more heat, they become more intense. Climatologists and people looking at this are still debating about whether the number of hurricanes is related to global warming. But there is no debate about whether or not the intensity of hurricanes is related to global warming. This chart is, I think, just as clear as it can be. The solid line is the sea surface temperature. The intensity of the storms, you couldn't almost design a line that was more closely matched. It makes sense. Hurricanes get their energy from the ocean, and that energy is greater when the ocean is warmer. They get more energy, they're more intense, they cover bigger areas, and they do much more damage. When those hurricanes hit shorelines that are now higher than they were before, they are hitting more vulnerable shorelines, so they do more damage. Hence the kind of damage we associate with Katrina and Ike and recent storms. Now, if this weren't bad enough in itself, the other component that I want you to understand is what are called positive feedback loops. Positive feedback means when something happens, what the mere fact that it's happening creates more of the same. I guess the example I use best is, although you wouldn't consider it positive, is you get out of bed in the morning and you stumble your toe on the bed or something, And the rest of the day just seems to go worse. You're walking around with your foot hurt, and you run into the door jamb. And then, damn, then now you're swearing, and your wife gets up, and she's angry. You know, if you haven't had days like that, you're a lucky person. But that's happening in climate science, and it's happening in the global warming debate. One of the best examples that brings together many of the components of this positive feedback, another word for positive feedback is acceleration. It is, once something happens, it creates conditions for more of that to happen and other things that happen that add to the thing that started it. Let's use Greenland and the ice sheet in Greenland as an example. First, let's get a sense of the scale. Have any of you ever flown over Greenland? There's some pilots in here, you'll have a sense of the scale. But the average person doesn't, because we look at maps that really don't project Greenland in the way you can understand it. At the bottom of that ice pack, right there, and this was 1979, to the top of that ice pack, right up there, imagine that's Key West, Florida. That's 100 miles north of Portland, Maine. That point there is Washington, D.C. That point there is Indianapolis. That ice cap holds more water than the Gulf of Mexico, holds 8% of the world's fresh water in that one continent. Now, we know the ice cap is melting, and that's how much it's melted up until last year. Well, if that's Key West, where's that? Charleston? I don't know. You know, these are areas that are melting. Now, the positive feedback comes when this ice cap starts to melt. The waters go down into the crevices in between the ice. It lubricates the land-ice interface so that as pieces break off, they fall more quickly into the ocean, slide more quickly into the ocean. That change in the salinity represented by the fresh water going into the ocean changes the currents, and the currents are changing such that what the Gulf Stream, which is what has kept Northern Europe habitable for the last couple thousand years, is moving to the west. That's moving the warm water from the southern climes closer to Greenland and then causing, of course, increasing melting. Moreover, all of you know that something white reflects heat better than something dark. So the loss of that mass, that area of reflective white ice, the same way the loss of the Arctic ice or the Antarctic ice, means that we are not reflecting back into the air, into the atmosphere, as much heat as we otherwise would. We're absorbing it in this darker land. And that whole progression of mini catastrophes, if you will, is what a positive feedback loop is. There are others. Actually, I'll do one real quick one. Forest fires. Forest fires burn trees. Trees sequester CO2. Forest fires, therefore, put limits on the ability to take CO2 out of the air. Forest fires not only do that, they put smoke in the air, which is an even more powerful in the short term greenhouse gas than even the CO2. Well, when you get the change in climate that results from these from this climate change, one of the big things is drought. These forests now no longer can thrive as well because it's drier. Well, what happens in a drier forest? They burn faster. They get caught on fire more. And so you could see how this would just sort of accelerate out of control. And that's positive feedback. Doesn't sound very positive to me, but that's what the scientists call us. Now, we've seen pictures of Greenland. You've all seen pictures of the polar bears and other dramatic presentations of what's happening with global warming, but it's happening here in Virginia too. And when was the last time you saw a really healthy stand of corn? It's just amazing. We were over in the valley yesterday, and I had forgotten what tall corn looks like, but they must have had good rain this summer or something, but up around Dayton and Harrisonburg, it looked like corn that it ought to be. But I haven't seen that kind of corn in central Virginia in a long time. It's because we've been having droughts, because farmers may even plant two or three times before they get a stand. And, of course, by the time the fall comes, they don't get much of a stand because their growing season has been dramatically limited. We are losing the ability to control certain natural phenomenon. Aphids are a good example. I have a friend who has a farm in Fluvanna County, and he tells me that he used to get 2 to 3 years out of an alfalfa crop. Now he gets barely a year because the aphids overcome the alfalfa. Now, why are the aphids so dramatically more powerful? They're not. But they're not being killed by cold weather in the wintertime. And when it doesn't get cold in the winter, the aphid population is not brought down, and it's even more more numerous in the spring, hence alfalfa is no longer a viable crop, at least for this farmer. When we're not getting drought, what we're getting is episodic rains, heavy rains. So if you look on the chart, the progress has it in periodically, and where are we in rain? You know, did we catch up? Is the reservoir up? Is the reservoir down? And we're not always running as far behind as we might think, thinking how dry it's been and everything else. But we get these episodic rains that come and dump inches of rain on us in 2 or 3 days. Much of that runs off. It runs off the dry soil because the soil won't absorb it. It runs into creeks and rivers. So the reservoir might look good, but I can tell you the water tables don't look good. On my farm, I've lived there for 35 years now. When I bought the place, it was a stream up to my waist. Ran that way all the time. When it rained heavy, it was over the road. Now, if there's a continuous flow of water in the stream, I think I'm doing well. That's down 3 feet permanently. I mean, it may come back someday, but it is not coming back in the course of a year. And that's because the rain we get isn't getting into the soil. Snow? When was the last time we had good snow in the wintertime? Does anybody remember? Maybe 3, 4 years? Well, you know, snow is the best thing for the water table because when it melts, it all gets into the ground. It doesn't run off. So without that snow recharging the water table in the wintertime, we're not getting our water table back. So not only are we getting these heavy episodic rains, but the rains themselves are storms. And these storms are much more powerful than typically we're used to. And they do more damage because trees, especially their root systems, are weakened when they're drought-starved. So you got a tree that's weakened by drought, and then you have these heavy storms that come through, so you get a lot of trees knocked down. And those trees, obviously knocked down, aren't going to sequester carbon. And as important as those trees rot, on the forest floor they release methane, which we already said is a pretty powerful greenhouse gas. So these are not inconsequential events. If you're a gardener, you know what I'm about to show you. If you plant shrubs and things in your yard, you'll know what I'm about to show you. But I find this dramatic, actually. These are the climate zones. If you ever gone to buy a plant that says, well, if you're in climate zone 7, that's the yellow, this will grow for you. If you're in climate zone 8, or what would be up there, north 6, this will grow for you. But it reflects what you can anticipate over, 10, 12 years maybe in terms of temperature. Well, look what's happened. Take the yellow. That's our climate zone. Here is 1990. We had one little patch of zone 8 in the middle of the state, and up in the upper valley and toward the northwestern part of the state, we got into the zone 8. All the rest of the Commonwealth was in zone 7. Now, look at 2006. We've lost almost all of the zone 8, except down here in the far southwest. Zone 7 has gone up into central Pennsylvania. Zone 8, if I got that right? Yeah, zone 8 is now coming into, there's even a little patch of it, I don't know where that might be, but it's coming into the state. That's a clear reflection of the way temperatures are moving north or south, depending how you want to look at it. That's 16 years. Think about the creatures who have become habituated to this kind of weather system. They can't move that fast. We are going to see creatures, both plants and animals, become extinct, and they're already counting numbers that have become extinct because they can't move as fast as the climate's moving. A salamander doesn't have much of a range, and they're not going to be able to move as quickly. So that's happening in our own Commonwealth. Well, you got air conditioning, you got heat, what does it matter? Well, around here especially, you know it matters because When farmers go out of business, first thing that happens is that the farm is torn down, the land becomes subdivided, population shifts from rural to urban areas, and you have issues around growth and issues around livability that are pretty well articulated in this community. We are converting in Virginia 45,000 acres a year. Now, we may not be right now because of the economic crisis. There's a silver lining in it, it's that, because it's, people aren't looking at building new subdivisions to speculate. But 45,000 acres a year had been being lost in Virginia to subdivision. That's land going out of farming that cannot produce fuel in the future. That's not insignificant. Let me tell you what's happening in my little county of Nelson. Some years ago, we decided as a county that we would put our faith in tourism. We hadn't had any luck attracting industry, so we figured we might as well do something that might work. Wintergreen was there. Wintergreen was doing well. There's a lot of tourism ancillary business that's grown up around Wintergreen. In fact, the county is paying for 3 new schools with the revenues predominantly from tourism, from taxes based on tourism. Well, the biggest chunk of the taxes come from Wintergreen, and the biggest chunk of Wintergreen's revenues come from the winter season because it has traditionally been the furthest south, really halfway decent skiing area. So you'd get busloads of people coming from Atlanta, busloads of people coming from Florida to go skiing on a weekend in Wintergreen. Well, when it's warm in the winter, you can't make snow. When it's warm in the summer and there's a drought, there's no water in Lake Monica in the lake that they use to feed the water into the snow machines. You don't have water to make snow. And so what we are facing very possibly is the engine for our little economic model that said we can make this much money from tourism, therefore we can borrow the money to build the schools. That engine is sputtering to a close. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, we might get a nice cold winter this year. We might have enough water for snow. But over time, this is going to change the economic situation in my little county. Many other counties are facing similar kinds of changes in how they look at what they're going to be doing. Now, let's get a little more dramatic. The Governor's Climate Change Commission is looking at this very, very carefully. Virginia has the second most vulnerable coastline on the East Coast for sea level rises. And the Virginia problem is being complicated or being compounded by the fact that our coastline, especially in the bay, is sinking. During the Great Glacial Age, the earth was actually pushed up as the glaciers came down from the north and came, I guess they got as far as Pennsylvania, but they pushed the earth in front of them. So the Chesapeake Bay coast is sinking at about a foot a century anyway, because the land is subsiding, millions of years after the end of the glacier, or how many years was the glacier? I don't know. But so that's going down. The water is coming up, and the sea level rise, this is a projected 1 meter sea level rise. Many of you will know this. That's Fort Monroe. This is what will be flooded in the Hampton Roads area, just on this side. Here's where the tunnel goes under the James River to go over to Norfolk. So that amount of land will be flooded. When you flood that kind of land and then you get an ordinary hurricane, the storm surges of 6 foot don't start back here. They start back here. And then you see how much further in they can go. What does this mean for public policy? You know, if we ever got any agreement on what to do about transportation investments, they're talking about spending $10 billion in transportation in this area. Much of that area will be underwater. Just last month, the governor proudly announced that a consortium of Arriva, McDonnell Douglas, and one other major company have come together to build parts to supply the coming construction boom in nuclear plants. The state paid $3 million as, I don't know, earnest money or whatever the state, however they figure what they're doing with their money, to get this group together, and they paid them $3 million to locate right there. Now, the irony is that most people, and I'm one of them, think that nuclear power needs to be a weapon in our arsenal to fight global warming. But to then fail to recognize the very thing that you're trying to face and put a production facility using taxpayer monies right where it's going to be most immediately affected by the global warming you're trying to, it either suggests a great deal of confidence or a failure to pay attention to the reality. So I think that we need to be worried about that. I mentioned the fact that as the shoreline comes in, what you're doing, just imagine any shore that you're familiar with, any place that you value on the coast. You know what that coastline looks like. The sea has beat it. The waves have beaten it. It's hardened. You go to the Outer Banks. That whole dune system is designed to protect land in further from, not design, but does protect land in further from these storm surges. Well, if the sea level has risen to the point that dune system is underwater, or these hardened shorelines are underwater, then a storm, even an ordinary storm, becomes more powerful in its ability to blast through. What did they say one of the big problems in Katrina was that the wetlands had been drained, and these, now that's not related to global warming, that's related to population or land use changes, but they drained the wetlands, and the wetlands had a very real purpose in slowing down these storms as they came ashore. When the wetlands are gone, that slowing mechanism is gone. Well, we're going to see a lot more of that, and we're going to see when we have these storms a decreasing reluctance in the part of public officials to discuss the concern that, do we rebuild these cities? Do we put good money after bad? It was very, very, very lightly discussed after Katrina. It was a little bit more visible this time after Ike. Each storm raises the visibility. But let me tell you, that's politicians talking. Commerce and business is already talking. If you live in the Tidewater area today, it's almost impossible for you to get casualty insurance on your house, because they don't want to flood places that are going to be washed away by storms. I have a friend who has a beautiful house in Virginia Beach, quite lovely, and he has to go to Lloyd's of London to get insurance on his house. Now, he's moving to Nelson County. He doesn't claim that he's a global warming refugee, but I tell him he is, and he doesn't argue with me. All of these changes, businesses moving ahead on it, politicians may not want to admit it. We may put $3 million in tax money in downtown Newport News, but Allstate's not going to insure it. I can guarantee you that. In 2005, the insurance industry paid out a record of $57 million in weather-related losses. And the industry, in part, has reacted by raising rates for everyone. In 2006, the rates that I pay for my farm went up 40%. I haven't had a claim ever with that company, but they went up 40%. They had to get their revenue from someplace. They reached out and they got it from me, among others. So we know that there's already enough CO2 in the air to raise the water levels by a meter, but as I say, the Governor's Climate Change Commission may decide that it's more. Now, what do we do about this? We all have individual things we can be doing about it. If we take this seriously, we need to be careful about how we use energy. We can conserve energy. We can do things more energy efficiently. One interesting thing you can do is find out what your own personal carbon footprint is. There's a number of websites you can go to, and you can just see how much carbon you are creating just in your normal life, and you get suggestions on how to cut them down. Back there, Mrs. Abbott's got a whole stack of sheets you can pick up that will just pick up one. There's a stack of sheets there. Pick up one. That can tell you what you personally can do, and you ought to be considering that. But that's not going to get there. That's not going to get us there, and that's why we're focusing on the public policy. We're going to have to work together, not only as individuals, but as individuals in part of a political system. And what we're going to have to work together to do is to build a new green energy economy. We need to change the energy culture. Now, this isn't going to happen unless we get serious political leadership. It isn't going to happen unless, when someone asks you for your vote, you say, what's your position on climate change? What's your position on coastal flooding? What are you planning to do about that? What do you think about, you know, you can question him on this, and you ought to. That's the only way we're going to get the political will to do something about this instead of, and lead to a better energy economy. Now, I have this slide, came out of, obviously, you can see by the style, something probably from the 50s. The reality is we've been asking for cheap electricity. The electric companies have just given us what we've asked for. We as consumers have said we want cheap electricity. We want to be able to power everything we own with electricity. And I don't want to stand here and demonize electric companies. I don't think that gets me anywhere. I don't think that moves this game forward at all. I would like us to find ways to get the energy companies, the electricity companies, to lead rather than stand behind. In some states, that has happened dramatically. Colorado is a good example. The Colorado legislature passed a bill that required its utility to have 10% of its total power provided to the customers in the state of Colorado, 10% come from renewable sources by the year 2008. Oh, we can't do it. It'll destroy our economy. We'll, you know, our investors will be upset. It just won't happen. Their legislature, I don't know what they call it, they said do it. Well, by 2006, the company had met the 10% goal, and in 2008 and came back and said, we'd like to try to do another 10 to 15% in the next 8 years because they're finding it's good business, it makes sense to them, and they can do it. So power companies, if they put their energy and their innovative capabilities and their engineers to work, can do a lot to change the way we do energy. So I want them on our side. You won't see me in a picket line against Dominion, although this morning we were testifying against, or had a lawyer testifying against, one of their renewable energy tariffs because it's not very good. But we want them to do it right. We don't want them not to do it. All right, let's just summarize at this point, and we'll get into the downhill part. Global warming exists. I don't think there's any doubt. If you doubt that, that's entirely up to you. There's broad scientific consensus, as Don has stated. We need to change the energy culture. We need to stop putting CO2 in the air. And we can only do so much as individuals. So that's kind of where I hope we are now, and you're all there with me. Now, I want to talk about renewable energy. There are lots of forms of renewable energy, energy that does not create open-loop CO2 when it's burned. But let's look at what our possibilities are in Virginia. And here's a list of the sort of broad categories of renewable energy. Hydro, clean. Water falls over a dam, runs a turbine, and no carbon dioxide goes in the air. But we've pretty much developed all our hydro capability in the Commonwealth. There may be one or two rivers that left could use low fall, but for the most part, the balance between wildlife in the waterways and the power capability has pretty much been reached. Low wind potential. You know of the dispute over the Highland County wind farm, but there aren't that many places on land in the Commonwealth that will be good for wind power. Offshore, that technology has not been fully developed yet, but offshore there's probably a good possibility. But one of the things we're finding this in difficult places, one of the things Public Policy Virginia is studying, is the fact that the grid that brings us electricity is designed to bring electricity to where the people are. So power plants are sited with that in mind. It's not designed to capture electricity from where it might be produced under a renewable energy economy. So you have the irony of a big wind farm in northern New York producing megawatts of power, but the grid is too small, literally too small, for it to sell that power into the New York market, New York City market, where the demand is. So there's been this disconnect. The reason why the Highland County wind farm was limited to 39 megawatts was that's all the grid could take. They could put more up there, but that's all the grid could take. Now, 39 megawatts is a lot of juice, but 39 megawatts won't even power the city of Charlottesville. So it doesn't go a long way to replacing energy with renewable energy. Limited solar potential. Thank goodness we're not Nevada. We're not Arizona. We don't have that kind of sun. There's really no geothermal energy potential. We can use geothermal to heat our houses, but we don't have the kind of hot water resources that you have out on the Pacific Rim that are associated with active volcanoes. But what we do have is world-class biomass resources. We've got woods, we've got forests, we've got good temperate growing lands. We have generally adequate rainfall to grow crops. And that's where the future is, I think, in Virginia, and what we as an organization are working hard for. So you have the possibility to use this symbol of a water mill, but in fact it's a leaf and it's a, well, it's just a pretty slide, but I hope it sticks in your mind. Let's look at where this renewable energy might come from, biomass energy might come from. This is a list of operating biopower capacity in the United States by fuel type. So most of that's pretty obvious, wood or wood waste, refuse, that's unprocessed municipal solid, you can read it. About the only thing that may not be clear to you, pulping liquor is a byproduct of the paper industry, so it's also called black liquor. Bagasse may not be familiar with you, that's sugarcane waste. Peat, well, you know what peat is. So these are all pretty much obvious to you. And this is what they represent in total megawatts, installed capacity. Put that in perspective. The Dominion requirements for peak power in its service area is about 19,000 megawatts. So this doesn't even represent half, nationwide, represent half of what the biggest utility in our state needs to serve its service area. So we have a long way to go. But we have a lot of opportunity to do that. We have wood residues, which include these components. There's lots of wood in Virginia, lots of wood industry in Virginia. I had a conversation with a man who runs a large sawmill down in the Northern Neck. And he said, you know, Al, when I buy a tree, I'm paying the same price for sawdust as I am paying for high-grade timber. Think that through. And that man has figured out the way he's going to make money in that business and keep that business going is to make more energy, make more use from that sawdust than he's ever been in the past. Oh, all of that stuff is replanted. These old sawmills that have been operating, they've been operating in those areas for 100 years, some of them. And they work with the landowners, and they know that's their resource. Hardwood in Virginia, which is not replanted because it just replants itself, hardwood in Virginia in most years grows faster than it's harvested. So we have a lot of wood resources. We have agricultural residues. This slide isn't exactly keyed toward Virginia. Corn stover, that's, of course, the corn stalks after you've taken the ears off. We don't have too much in the way of rice hulls. We do have some cotton gin waste. We do grow cotton in Virginia. We don't have any bagasse, but we do have a world, let me tell you, a world of animal biosolids. We were up in the Shenandoah Valley the other day and looking at a prototype, a piece of equipment that will take chicken litter right out of the chicken house into a hopper, run it up a screw thing into a reactor that will convert the chicken waste to burnable gas. So once they start it with propane, one of the gas lines goes right back into the burning thing and is creating the fire, and it will create a usable oil. Now, it's a heavy oil, but it can be burned for heat or anything else. So they figure they can, and this is portable. It's on, you can pull it around with a big pickup truck and move it from place to place. So why they did this was not to create energy. They did it because they needed to come up with a way to deal with the excess nutrients that are related to putting animal waste on the land. And it's a big problem with the bay because all that runs off into the watershed for the bay and runs down to the bay. So one of the byproducts of this processing, and the one they were originally shooting for, is a char. It's like charcoal. It's a very, very fine charcoal. But it takes all those nutrients and it buffers them. So they're very slow release. It makes a wonderful soil addition. And in fact, there are some scientists who now say that getting that char into the soil will be one of the keys to reversing that 350 number I talked about, because that char is actually taking CO2 out of the air and sequestering it in a way that won't come back. So there's a lot of possibilities and a lot of people working on it. Of course, we have the energy crop potential. This is crops planted specifically for that purpose. Hybrid poplars, switchgrass you've all heard of, willow, wood chips, I guess wood chips from the hybrid poplar. There's canola, there's soybeans, there's lots of them. None of us in this game seriously are talking about corn ethanol much anymore. I'd be glad to answer any questions on that afterwards, but it's not a factor in Virginia, and it's probably not a factor in the future of bioenergy in America. Okay, this is important. We can do it. It's something that has to be done if we're going to make a difference as a commonwealth and take advantage of it, as well as make money. This is the thing that's going to drive the change in our rural economies. This is the thing that's going to lead to green jobs, to vast changes, I believe, in land use management. And I spoke to the governor's climate change commission, and I said, I know you guys are thinking about all this, but maybe you ought to make some recommendations about how we preserve land so it's available for these opportunities down the road, and it's not a subdivision. It's hard to plant switchgrass in a shopping center parking lot. All right. On the local level, then, what can you do to help this happen? Let me go back, see if I can get back there. Oh, wrong way. There you are. I want to see that happen. I hope you all do too. So what do you do? Well, you've got to demand it. You've got to give a voice to the marketplace that says, I will pay for this. I will do it even though today it might be more expensive. That's what our Green Choice Virginia program is about. There's some papers back there. It's very simple. Pick up a postcard. If you're a Dominion customer, pick up a Dominion card. If you're a Central Virginia Electric Co-op, pick up one of those. Write to the head of those organizations and say you want a real green power choice. Because if we do our job in creating a biomass resource industry, you need to do your job to create a demand. So you have supply, you have demand, and then that's what moves things forward. That's what helps the market to make it happen. On the state level, there is something called conservation pricing. They use it in California. That's why we use this little slide. Conservation pricing essentially says to an electric company, you know, boys, you've been getting paid for the power you sell me. We're going to figure out a way to pay you for the power I don't use. Now, that's kind of hard to get your hand around, but 23 states have something like that. And the state of California pioneered this. It's decoupling is the more technical term, but it's essentially rewarding electric companies for figuring out ways not to produce power. And so their shareholders benefit in the same way they would if they were producing power, but you don't have to build new power plants. You don't have to build new coal-fired plants. You don't have to burn the most dirty plants to meet peak demand because you've reduced demand so that you're not loading so much carbon in the air. Why Hollywood? California uses half the energy per capita that we use in Virginia. And I don't think anyone would think that the lifestyles in California are any worse than they are in Virginia. It can be done. The other thing that we'd like to see done is talk to your delegate, Rob Bell or David Toscano, or depending how far you've come, and tell him you want to see something called impact pricing. They don't do that in this state. I'm not sure if they do it in many places. But basically, do you all remember the debate over the windmills in Highland County? Oh, this is our county. That's my vista. That's my this. And I said that dismissively. I didn't mean to. Those were heartfelt concerns about the change in their community to provide alternative energy for all of us. So what are we saying? We're saying this community is going to have a biofuels plant. This community is going to have a windmill farm. This community is going to have a nuclear reactor. And that little community is paying the price so all of us can get better energy. There ought to be a way to reward them, and our idea is what we call impact pricing. If you are in a community that is impacted by the development of new and alternative energy, you get a break in your electricity rates. You get a reward for that. You get some payback for losing something, whether it's just psychological or whether it is in fact very real. That's the marketplace. You want to see projects go through, Wait till you see places where that will be competing to get the impact rates so they don't have to do the NIMBY thing. We can do that if the state says do it. Now, that we call that conservation pricing. That's impact pricing. Actually, those windmills are in a county in West Virginia. Unfortunately, ours aren't built yet, but we're hoping that at some point it'll look like that. Now, I'm going to finish up by talking about what I think is the most important thing you can do if you want to see a change in the way we do energy. The most important thing you can do is probably the hardest thing that you can do. And I'm not talking about turning your thermostats down. I'm not talking about driving a Prius. I'm not talking about walking from here to home, although all of those might be a good idea. What I'm talking about is understanding that if we do not put a realistic price on carbon, the carbon that comes from fossil fuels will never change the energy market. And if we don't do it wisely, we will lose the power of the free market to move us forward. Let's talk about this. You may be familiar with cap and trade. You've probably heard, I used it in the pre-survey of carbon taxes. All of what they're trying to do with those two kinds of policies is make carbon from fossil fuel more expensive. Something's more expensive, you use less of it. We know that. We have $1 a pack taxes on cigarettes in some states. Why? To keep people from smoking. Doesn't seem to work too well, but at least that's one of the logical arguments for it. You know, when gas was $4 a gallon, you were driving a lot less. You were thinking about it. You were riding with people you wouldn't otherwise even want to talk to, because at $4 a gallon, you can make a lot of friends. Well, that's what pricing carbon fairly will do. If we don't do that, what we're going to see is the failure of any move over the long term toward alternative energy. Carbon taxes are better than cap and trade. Very quickly, so you understand both elements. Cap and trade basically says you are a power plant and you are polluted, you are putting so much CO2 in the air. We're going to either give you or sell you, there's a big debate about that, sell you the rights to put that much carbon dioxide into the air. But next year, we're only going to sell you 90% of those same rights. So you have got to reduce your carbon output 10% in the next year. Now, we know you can't do it, or maybe you can't do it. So you can buy reductions of CO2 from someone else to meet that standard. And the idea is that I'm an old plant. It would be expensive for me to reduce 10%. You're a new plant. If I put my money into your new plant, we get the reduction, the economy benefit or the atmosphere benefits. They've tried this in Europe. It's very difficult to do. It requires a fairly large bureaucracy. And the really downside to it is it only deals with large power facilities, and it only deals with large industrial facilities. It does very little, if nothing, for CO2 emitted out of the tailpipes as we burn gasoline, because there's no cap and trade on that. Although, wouldn't that be interesting? If you were driving an SUV, you got so many carbon rights and you can trade with somebody with a Prius. And imagine the administration that would take to make that work. Carbon taxes, on the other hand, put a tax right at the wellhead or at the minehead and say carbon that's in this oil, in this natural gas, in this coal will become increasingly expensive over time. And we know that. All of us consumers will know when we go to buy a car, when we go to buy a stove, when we go to decide whether they're going to insulate our house or not, we will know where energy prices are going because it's built into the pricing. Now, when we say the carbon tax, I say it's factored into the cost of fuel and it will rise over time. Now, when you say taxes, I'm not stupid. I run for office. Well, maybe that sort of is an oxymoron, isn't it? Nobody likes to talk about taxes. I'm not talking about a tax that's going to be a line on your 1040 where you say, oh, I drove 50,000 miles this year. I'll send you another $35 or something. We're not even talking taxes like sales taxes that you will see in any transaction you do. We're talking taxes that are hidden in the cost of the products you buy. Let me give you an example. We don't like to call them carbon taxes. We like to call them carbon fees. These are fees that companies will pay if they want to discharge carbon into the air. It's the same thing as a land use fee. If you make garbage as part of your business and you take it to the landfill, you pay a fee. Now, if you go to a restaurant, you know that restaurant is taking its garbage to the landfill in some form, and you know that there's a cost to that, and you know that your dinner bill includes, in some small way, those landfill fees, and maybe even the better that restaurant is in reducing its garbage, the cheaper your meal will be. Maybe, maybe not. But the University of Virginia and the hospital have decided that their garbage waste is a pretty expensive proposition. They're going to compost it, put it into a use so they don't have to pay the landfill fees. Right there, they're going to save, I can't remember, I've seen the numbers, they're big numbers. They're going to save in university operations. That's landfill fees making them do that. Imagine what happens if you have carbon fees that make us change the way we use energy. So the other key part about this is that the energy price floor is absolutely vital. If we do not know that there is going to be an increasing cost in fossil fuel over time, then we will not make the decisions that lead us away from fossil fuel. We will not wean ourselves from oil unless we have an incentive to do it. Oil can be brought out of the ground in Saudi Arabia at $3 to $4 a barrel. They were getting $140 a barrel not 2 months ago. That's a lot of money coming out of our pockets going overseas. You can't make long-term investments unless the energy costs that you're trying to compete with are at a comparable level. No bank will lend an investor money to build an alternative energy plant unless that investor has long-term contracts to sell that alternative energy. No rational person is going to commit for long-term energy contracts unless they know that the alternatives are going to be expensive and not worth buying. Look what happened to gas prices just in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Worldwide demand because of the economic crisis has dropped 5%. Gasoline prices have dropped 50%. In 97, 98, when the Asian crisis hit and worldwide demand dropped 15%, gasoline prices dropped 75%. How can anybody make rational decisions when that's happening? And oil is so cheap to produce, they can always jack the market around and control the market. And unless we have a way to put a floor under energy prices and control those, we won't see the market make a response that we need to see. And that's the danger. The market is the most effective way to get us forward on this, and we are basically not letting it go. Everyone I've talked to in business who deals with this issue says, give us a carbon tax. We know what it'll cost us. We know how to beat it. We know how to beat our competitors. Every economist says a carbon tax is what's important. The only people who aren't talking about carbon taxes are politicians. And yet they'll talk all day long about what they want to do about global warming, except the most important thing. But they're not alone. They're not alone because we're all part of this army of, I won't say anything, that's not right. But the Miller Center recently completed a survey, a well-done survey that is quite, you know, it's a methodologically correct, of citizens in Virginia. What they were trying to do was see whether our attitudes as citizens of Virginia are the same as nationwide. Here's what they found. This is what's interesting. 75% of Virginians in total believe that the globe is warming. They have all different reasons for believing that, but they believe it's happening. 80% of Democrats, 88% of Democrats say that, 57% Republicans, 75% Independents. You can speculate why that difference is. I don't care. It doesn't matter. Because here's the more important part of their survey. 39% believe man has had something to do with it. That was one of the questions I asked you. 20% believe it's just pure natural cycles, and 30% believe it's a combination of both. Okay. Now, for the people who believe that man has got something to do with it and who say government should do something or help us do something about it, these are the programs, policies they will support. You can see if there's any you don't understand, renewable portfolio standards, clean coal technology, these CAFE mileage standards for automobiles. LEED standards, it's better building technology for building buildings, tax credits for hybrid cars, nuclear power, increased ethanol development. What is striking about these policies that they would support, and the question was strongly support. In other words, this is not just, maybe it's a good idea. I would strongly support that. What is striking about that is the next slide. We leave aside restrictions on suburban development, but the three things that would make those policies possible fall right down the bottom of the list of what people would strongly support. You cannot, take my word for it, you cannot get clean coal technology if you don't have high energy prices. You don't have taxes on carbon and coal. Why would they? Why would they spend the money? You cannot get increased CAFE standards unless gasoline prices are high. It won't happen. So we have a political or a psychological disconnect that we won't face up to, or we haven't faced up to. I think we will. It is my hope that we will. And if we do that, then there is the possibility that we can convert from the kinds of energy we've been using to green, clean energy. And, you know, after this election, at least we had two candidates running, both of whom agreed we could do this. We needed to do something about it. America understands the challenge, as I said in the beginning. We can face up to this. We can prosper from it. Europe is moving ahead of us on this in big ways. Europe is going to lock up the market for new technology because they have taken this seriously. We're giving up a competitive edge by sitting on our hands. We can't afford to let oil continue to dominate our economy. And Al Gore said we need to get rid of oil in 10 years. I'm not sure that's possible. But that's as good a challenge as John F. Kennedy gave when he said we need to put a man on the moon. How many of us thought that was possible? Gore said when he issued this call, he said, "Of course there are those who will tell us this can't be done. Some are defenders of the status quo, those with a vested interest in perpetuating the current system, no matter how high a price the rest of us have to pay. But even those who reap the profits of the carbon age have to recognize the inevitability of its demise. As one OPEC oil minister was observed to say, the Stone Age didn't end because of a shortage of stones." So we're going to end the oil age if we move in a different direction. Let me leave you with one last word. William Ruckelshaus, who was the first chairman of the Environmental Protection Agency appointed by Nixon, in 1980 wrote in the Scientific American, he said, "We will never have a world at peace unless people feel they have an opportunity for prosperity all around the world." He also said that if everyone in the world, and then they were talking maybe 1980, 4 billion people, if everyone reaches for prosperity in the same way we have reached it, we will destroy the earth. And we're seeing that happen as China and India are increasing their use of carbon. It's a global problem, but we have to do our share. Okay. I want to stop because I know you want to ask some questions. Let's do it. Let's have some questions.
One thing I've never heard anybody talk about is making a concentrated effort towards population control. You know, if we could reduce the population by half, a lot of our problems would be resolved.
Well, you're right, and not to talk about population as part of the problem is to be short-sighted. But I'll tell you an anecdote that gets to the answer on this. When I worked at the World Bank as a young man, we had a division called the Population Division, and the purpose of that division was to try to minimize population growth in poor countries because it just you never could keep up with it. And every project they brought in had to do with neonatal care, it had to do with child health initiatives, it had to do with better medical care in general. And finally, one of the directors of the bank said, "I don't understand what's going on here." He said, "We're trying to limit population growth, but everything we're doing is increasing population growth." And the answer was, and fairly scientifically proven, that people have less children if they know the children they have will live. People have less children if they know they won't need a dozen children to have two to keep them alive in their old age. And in every country that has reached prosperity, population has declined. Western Europe has a negative population growth rate. If they didn't have immigration in Western Europe, their population would be, you know, plummeting. Without immigration, our population is fairly stable in America. So the answer is to deal with population, to give people the tools to try to control population, but it is also to understand that one of the things that will happen with prosperity is that we will have fewer people. Now, is that a doable thing? I hope so.
Yes, could you spend a little bit more time on public policy, Virginia, your organization, and what do you do with the output that you do, and how do you relate to the state?
Thank you for the question. We are, as Don said, a 501c3. We depend on charitable contributions. And our niche is to deal with, at the grassroots level, you folks, to try to inform you and persuade you to talk to your political leaders about these public policy issues. So if you go out of here learning one or two things that you didn't know when you came in and connect them with one or two issues that you think are important, I will have done my job. Now, we don't just go around and give talks, although we're pretty busy doing that. We are working with Virginia Tech to do the first statewide assessment of our biomass resources. It's pretty difficult to make sensible public policy when you don't know what the universe you're trying to deal with consists of. And it's easy to say, well, all of that chicken litter over in the valley, that's animal waste. We can make energy from that. But that chicken litter represents fertilizer. There's an economic value to that. There are problems with transporting it. There are security problems, what they call biosecurity. When you're moving that around, you're moving avian viruses around too. So there are a lot of public policy issues that will arise as we actually focus on doing something with renewable energy. So on that side, we're working to on this first assessment of Virginia's biomass resources. On the that's the supply side. And the demand side, we have this Green Choice Virginia. We want you to go out of this room with something you can do besides or in addition to putting a better light bulb in your home lighting fixtures. We want you to be able to send a letter to your power company or a postcard saying you want a green choice. So we do that. We work on briefing for politicians, and we're nonpartisan. We don't take any political. We don't endorse any politicians, but we offer ourselves up as a source of information about these issues, about how renewable. Our expertise, we'd like to think, is in biomass resources. So we build out from that. And we're very small. We're located just across the street, actually, on Woodbrook Drive. We have a research office up there. We have a small staff. And we're beginning to have some impact. This hearing this morning at the State Corporation Commission about the renewable energy tariffs that both Appalachian and Dominion filed was held because we intervened and said this is public policy the public needs to have an input on, and there are real problems with these tariffs. As I said earlier, we're not fighting the tariff. Don't get me wrong. We're fighting the way they structured it because it's not going to do what they say it will do. We want Dominion to have a powerful, effective green tariff, but what they put in isn't that. So we had our say. But that's, you know, we're not a big organization. I hope that answers your question.
You have given a very interesting presentation, but it's sort of based on a lot of fear that really is not scientifically based. I'm speaking primarily of the fact that you're sort of, as Michael Crichton would say, you're sort of instilling a state of fear. You wrote a book on this, which was rather interesting.
Well, actually,
he found in his studies, he could not find, and he reviewed all of the climate warming scientists' information that he had, and very few of them had really good, vital information. He came to the conclusion that only about 0.6% or 1 degree of warming will take place in the next 50 to 100 years. And that's based on, he was a pretty good scientist himself. Now, in addition to that, I made a trip to Iceland last year. I wanted to see what was happening up there. I was fortunate enough to meet a fellow who is a geologist in Iceland. He said, we've had this going on since 1870. Slowly, each year, it's been going up. And there's no doubt about warming. I have no doubts about that. I have doubts about what's causing warming. So you can't answer, do you believe no, yes? You can't say maybe. There's a maybe in this that's not determined. And I don't see this as a substantial reason to believe that this country is going to survive based on what we do in a politicized situation. Explain to me why it is going to happen. You haven't got the facts shown. I haven't seen one thing except that one little survey that you indicated back there, maybe about the different types of biological fuels in this state of Virginia that we've got. That was pretty good. That was good. Looked like good information. What I don't understand, and I can't understand it, is why we are not looking at some of the real facts in this world instead of listening to 12,000 people who don't have a real good sense of balance on it.
Well, let me take that piece by piece. Michael Crichton is a medical doctor. He's not a climatologist. You're absolutely right. 95% of climatologists agree with global warming. Don is an astronomer. He's a scientist. You would not let him operate on you, I suspect. Well, nor should we take Michael Crichton's views. Excuse me? Well, so the other point to make in this is I heard a man whose military experience I respect, and I identified immediately with this observation. He said, when I'm in command of a military unit in a crisis situation, if I wait for 95% of the facts to come in, I'm dead. I have to make decisions when 60% of the facts are in, and more than 60% of the facts are in. And the fact, nobody is denying that there are cyclical changes in the climate. Nobody is denying that at all. What they are stating, as that initial slide I showed, demonstrates that the curve has gone up dramatically, and the curve correlates statistically with carbon loading in the atmosphere. Now, I gave you three reasons on that survey to support doing something about carbon loading. You don't have to do it because you think CO2 is coming from fossil fuel and making the earth warmer. You could do it because you think Virginia's economy might benefit. You could do it because you think it would be better if we produced energy in this country and not imported from the Middle East. I don't have to persuade you as to my particular view as to why we should get there. I just hope to persuade you to do something about where we are.
I'm adding a lot of other possibilities in this. How about nuclear energy? We haven't talked about that.
I did talk about that. I said I'm in favor of nuclear energy.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I missed that. Another thing, you mentioned something about the Miller Center sponsoring this poll that came up. I didn't get that drift. I was there. The information I got that day, it was a forum that took place that was sponsored by the Miller Center. The survey was reported by somebody else.
But it was
I have bad facts, but I was there.
I have the survey. It said it was commissioned by the Miller Center. They have funding to do it, but it was commissioned by the Miller Center.
That might have been done, but they did
not.
Right. Rob?
Two comments. First, in response to your logic,
or lack thereof,
what you're saying is that over the past approximately 200 years, where we have extracted carbon that was sequestered millions of years ago, billions of tons of coal, billions of barrels of oil, that carbon has been released into the atmosphere, and you're saying that has no effect. Because the logic there is simply false. I don't care who does it.
From 1870 to the present time, there has been gradual warming in Iceland.
Well,
they have seen this. They know that.
So what is the effect of burning billions of tons of coal and billions of barrels of oil?
Well, let's carry it one step further.
What is the effect of burning billions of tons of oil, of coal, and billions of barrels of oil and releasing the atmosphere?
I'm not saying that. I'm agreeing with what you're saying on this one aspect.
That's the basic premise for this thing.
What I'm saying is something else. Listen to this. That this has been a gradual deal that's taken place. At that time, we were not burning all that coal then. We didn't have as much. A lot of things are missing in your analysis as well as mine. But what I'm trying to say, there is no scientific. Are you a scientist?
No.
Neither am I. What I'm saying is we need to sound our opinions based on information.
It isn't my authority. It is the logic of this consumption, this oxidation of carbon that had been sequestered. That's what we're trying to respond to. And I want to ask Al another question.
Okay,
but that's the illogic that you're
ignoring. I do not disagree with what you're saying about that.
Then we have to act on it.
What I'm agreeing to and also is the fact that we do need to have alternative methods of protecting our environment, of protecting us from pollution, all those things. But it's not going to do the job with the trillions of dollars that we're planning to spend on it.
Al, has Public Policy Virginia done research on decentralized generation of electrical power and energy storage that could match intermittent sources of power, such as solar or wind, more effectively against the consumption, the use of power? Because then you would not have the peak demand stress on the energy grid.
Well, we don't do original research. That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to connect the dots of research that's been done and the knowledge we have with the idea you need this information to make public policy. Let me give a couple examples of how that works for us. When we first got started some years ago on biofuels, we realized all around the Commonwealth there were people working on issues related to biofuels. But they weren't talking to each other. Not that they wouldn't, they just didn't know because nobody was focused on that issue in a broader way. So we brought together a lot of players from private industry, from academia, from just farmers who were interested in this and sat them down at a table and said, look, let's start talking about what you're doing, what you've learned from what you're doing, and then the lessons we've got from that we want to be able to help put out. So we communicate. The only thing I could say about your decentralized production question is that one of the tasks that we are signed up to do for this state assessment is to look at the grid. I alluded to it earlier. Maybe you hadn't gotten in yet. We have a grid that is designed to deliver power to end users but not necessarily pick up power from producers. And so we have a disconnect in the possibilities of decentralized generation because we don't know what the grid will do. And the power companies can tell us that to some extent, but we need to, I mean, if you're looking at putting in a biomass energy conversion operation in Southwest Virginia, for example, where the trees may be cheap and where the land is cheap and a lot of other advantages, but you have to pay into this regional electricity system millions or even billions of dollars to build a grid to take it out, you're not going to go there. Just like somebody's not going to locate in a town if there's no roads in and out so they can get their product in and out. But we don't have that kind of information, so we are doing that.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.